Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello, and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Strapinchik. In this episode, we'll speak with Sean Campbell of CHIRP, the Chicago Independent Radio Project, to discuss CHIRP and the status of radio in Chicago and in the United States. But now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
For a long time, the very idea of amending the U.S. Constitution filled many people on the left with dread, myself included. History has given us good reason to believe that masses of angry American white folk cannot be trusted anywhere near the Constitution. As often as not, those who called for changes in the text or interpretation of the Constitution were seeking to strip black people of any protections provided by that founding document. For that reason, when Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. and his assistant Frank Watson released their 2001 book, A More Perfect Union, with its call for 8 amendments to the Constitution, some of us that supported Jackson's political goals were nonetheless leery of the amendment process, which looked like the kind of national free-for-all, barroom brawl that the racist right is better at than the left is. Opening up the constitutional Pandora's box, we feared, would more likely result in the abolition of the Bill of Rights than in guarantees of the right to equal and high-quality education, affordable housing, full employment, or any other newly explicit constitutional rights. It seems safer to leave the Constitution alone, rather than risk setting a process in motion that the right might wind up controlling. But that was before the finance capitalist class swallowed the American state whole in 2008 and 2009, expropriating the current and future wealth and full faith and credit of the nation in order to back up their chips in Wall Street's casinos. Then, in January of this year, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that corporations have every right to use their ill-gotten trillions to monopolize the American political conversation. The Supreme Court empowered corporate speech to drown out all other speech in U.S. society. If there is to be any future for progressive electoral politics in the United States, indeed, if there is to be any point in conducting legal, above-ground political agitation of any kind, then the looming corporate monopoly on speech must be broken. Corporate power is the enemy of all humanity. It strangles the productive forces of the world in its tentacles, creating poverty and war as the inevitable consequence of its diabolical existence. Not one of the myriad crises that threaten the planet can possibly be resolved unless the death grip of international corporate power is removed from around humanity's throat. In the last decade, corporate power has infested the internal workings of black politics in the United States, spawning a new class of African-American political prostitutes beholden to their paymasters in the boardrooms. The battle for independent black politics is, of necessity, a fight against corporate power. The constitutional amendment route to limiting corporate speech is a long and dangerous one, requiring approval by 2/3 of the Congress and 3/4 of the states. But there is no short road to freedom from corporate rule. The constitutional amendment legislation introduced at the House by Representatives John Conyers and Donna Edwards deserves broad support as one of many strategies in the epic struggle to put people not corporations, in charge of human affairs. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. We now feature an interview with Sean Campbell of CHIRP, the Chicago Independent Radio Project, to discuss CHIRP and the status of radio in Chicago and in the United States. The following interview with Sean Campbell was recorded at the CHIRP Studios on Wednesday, February 17th, 2010. We are joined by Sean Campbell. Sean Campbell is the president and founder of CHIRP, the Chicago Independent Radio Project, and chirpradio.org. Sean, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
The Chicago Independent Radio Project. For listeners who may be unfamiliar with it, what is it?
Well, the Chicago Independent Radio Project is a nonprofit organization that I founded in 2007 to try to bring a brand new music and arts-focused community radio station to Chicago, which we've done, but also to work on broader issues like low-power FM and generally making the media more accessible to the public.
And you were feeling that this was not being met in the current radio landscape in Chicago, in your opinion. Is that correct?
Definitely.
Okay.
Definitely.
For people who wanted to listen, it's only online, but you're trying to get a broadcast radio license.
Well, we are. I mean, we're online at chirpradio.org right now, and we are working on the low-power FM issue as well. I will say, before I even go into that, that we don't see a broadcast license as the be-all and end-all of what we're doing. We, you know, we could go on doing what we're doing right now forever and not feel like we'd failed in any way.
Broadcasting online.
Right.
Okay.
With the changes that have happened, you know, even just in the past 3 years in terms of portability, in terms of being able to listen on smartphones and, you know, on your iPod Touch and what have you, you know, we don't feel like it will be a terrible thing if it never happens. We feel like a broadcast license would definitely augment what we're doing, but it's not absolutely crucial to what we're doing.
That, I guess we may be getting a little bit ahead of the game. You and I, having both been involved with not only radio but the local media activism scene, are familiar with the low-power FM movement and low-power FM radio. But for listeners who may be unfamiliar with it, explain a little bit.
Sure. Low-power FM is a service that was created by Congress in 2000. It provides stations that are licensed up to 100 watts to nonprofit community organizations. And so the idea is that you can get some of these voices that tend to be underrepresented in the mainstream media on the air. Unfortunately, the way that Congress created the service, they really limited the reach. Because there has to be, as that with the laws written, there has to be three clicks between every station on the dial. So, you know, for instance, if you're at, you know, at 93.1, the closest you can be is the 93.9, you know, click, 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 94.7, et cetera. And so in big markets like Chicago, and in fact in 49 out of the top 50 markets, there is absolutely no room for even a single low-power FM station.
In fact, there's actually legislation afoot now to help to try to remedy that, even though there are, I don't know, probably hundreds of low-power FM radio stations across the United States in the wake of the production of this service. There aren't in many in the larger major cities, but there's legislation afoot, the Local Community Radio Act, to try to address that.
Right.
Tell us more.
Sure. There are over 800 low-power FMs in America already, but the Local Community Radio Act would open up things to hundreds more stations, including stations in bigger markets. And all the Local Community Radio Act does is effectively remove one of those clicks. So instead of having to go click, click, click in between every station, you'd have to go click, click in between every station. This really helps things in secondary markets in particular. Chicago, New York, and LA, it still doesn't solve the problem, but what it does is it puts the matter back in the hands of the Federal Communications Commission, and they are able to look at exceptions and look at other ways to get new stations into the biggest markets. So what we see with the Local Community Radio Act is, first, it definitely helps the cause in general. It will create hundreds of new low-power FM broadcast licenses across the country. For the big markets, the biggest markets, what it does is allows us the flexibility to work with the FCC to find new methods of placing stations in cities like Chicago. And we have you know, we've met with FCC staff over the past couple of years, and
we at the CHIRP, you mean?
Yes,
I see.
And some of our national partners like Prometheus Radio Project and Free Press and the Future of Music Coalition, and there seems to be a willingness on the part of the FCC, at least according to staff, to find ways to place these stations in larger markets
to work with the law should it get passed.
Right. And we're really optimistic about the bill. This is the third Congress that it's been introduced in. And our bill has passed the full House of Representatives. It passed in December. And it's passed the Senate Commerce Committee. So, you know, the next step, like everything right now, mm-hmm. is a vote of the full Senate. There's not a question about whether it will be signed into law. We know that the president supports it. He was a co-sponsor of the bill when he was in the Senate. Mm-hmm. It's basically a non-controversial law. It has support from both the right and the left. In fact, when it passed the House, one of the people who spoke on its behalf was Joe Wilson, a Republican who yelled, "You lie," at Obama during the health care talk. So, I mean, it kind of makes for strange bedfellows in some ways. But everybody believes that their viewpoint is not represented by the mainstream media, whether you're on the left or the right. Mm-hmm. And so in this case, this is a truly bipartisan piece of legislation.
The mainstream broadcast industry has worked feverishly to try to either stop any kind of reform in radio, and certainly had been fighting tooth and nail against low-power FM. But have they just given up regarding this current Local Community Radio Act, or have they been defeated? What's the status as far as the major commercial broadcast lobby?
Well, the National Association of Broadcasters definitely fought against the bill the first two times it was introduced, and they're still fighting it, but kind of half-heartedly. Pretty much, they were really shown up in a hearing in the House, in the Subcommittee on Communications, where they had to make an argument that they were fine with what are called translators, which rebroadcast the signals of existing stations and just have effectively been used to build nationwide networks. So they had to argue in this hearing that translators, which are licensed at 250 watts and can be second channel adjacent, which means only one click in between them and a full power station on the dial. Mm-hmm. The NAB argued that translators are okay, but that low-power FMs licensed at 100 watts with, you know, the click, 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 the three spaces in between, would cause interference with full-power stations. And they basically got laughed out of the committee when they tried to make this argument. And I think that since then, the NAB, while they're still, like I said, kind of half-heartedly fighting it, I think they've decided they have bigger fish to fry, that there's more that they want from Congress that's more important to them than just getting low-power FM shut out.
Why did they try to make this argument?
Well, the original argument that they were making was that, you know, that these low-power 100-watt stations would interfere with their full-power signals. And in reality, we feel quite certain that they just don't want any additional competition. They're aware of the fact, the big broadcasters are aware of the fact that people are dissatisfied with commercial radio, and they have been losing audience, and they see anything that comes into the market as competition, you know, whether it's satellite radio or whether it's low power FM. They can't afford to lose audience, and they know that if people are looking for an alternative, well, here's an alternative, something that has, you know, is truly local, because low power FMs are by their nature local. They have to be. They have to be owned by a local owner. They're non-commercial, so you're not going to have 20 minutes of commercials an hour. Mm-hmm. And they really have to do some, some service to the community that they're in. So I think low-power FMs have all the strengths of radio that the big broadcasters have largely done away with.
Going back to the state of the legislation, it's passed the House. We're waiting for the Senate to act. Is there any indication of when the Senate could act?
No.
No?
There's not right now. We're working on it, and we're probably going to have some call-in days coming up, opportunities to call your senator, and, here in Illinois, of course, with Dick Durbin, the number two guy, he's expressed support, certainly, for a variety of media justice issues. His office has expressed support for CHIRP, but he was he's been a co-sponsor of the Local Community Radio Act. Mm-hmm. But what we'd really like him to do is really step up and take a leadership role on the bill.
In the event that it doesn't pass this current Congress, and given the state of affairs regarding the U.S. Senate, that's unfortunately quite likely, what then? Could it be reintroduced, or?
It can be reintroduced forever. You know, like I said, this is our third go-round already.
Okay.
And our national partners, again, are really optimistic this time around. They feel like the atmosphere is a lot different than it was the previous two times. And so, you know, they're optimistic. They remain feeling good.
Let's go with that thread. Suppose that it passes. Mm-hmm. Then what?
Well, then it goes back to the FCC to figure out what exactly the rules will be for the new application window that they'll have to put forward so that new applicants can apply for low-power FMs. We don't know right now if those will be the same standards that exist right now for low-power FMs, for, you know, the application window that they had previously, or if they'll want to write some new rules just based on the fact that it will open up some signals in more crowded markets. We're not sure yet.
Mm-hmm. Going back to, I guess, CHIRP and the founding philosophy of CHIRP, I can hear one line of argument that might be leveled against CHIRP, something along the lines of, well, you've already got a number of, maybe not necessarily entirely independent, but nonetheless more responsive local radio stations in Chicago, like WHPK or Radio Arte on the south side, or WZRD or LUW or NUR on the north side. So why the need for yet another radio station amidst the fact that we've already got these radio stations on both sides of the major Chicago airwaves?
Well, I mean, one thing you said in there is really crucial is, for the most part, not truly independent stations. Mm-hmm. You know, they're like, for the most part, those stations you mentioned are licensed to universities. That affects the people who are able to be involved in some cases. It means that there are, you know, that what I really realized at the time that I decided to found CHIRP, mm-hmm. was that if you don't, and you know, this was something that obviously I knew in the back of my mind all along, but if you don't control the license, you don't control the programming. Mm-hmm. At any point, the rug can be pulled out from under you if somebody else controls the broadcast license, or, you know, in our case, the web stream.
Right.
And so if you want to really be able to determine what the programming is for your station, you have to be independent. And those stations are not.
CHIRP has a mandate, or at least strives as to fulfilling of its mission, for providing content that no other stations would try to provide. Or at least that's my understanding of CHIRP's mission. Is that correct?
Well, it's important to note that we define ourselves as a music, arts, and culture station, first of all. So, I mean, that really is our mandate, is to provide a variety of music and arts-focused programming. And yes, the general idea is that most of it is stuff that you wouldn't readily find available in, you know, commercial radio.
Mm-hmm. Trying to achieve that mandate, you try to incorporate as many people as possible into participating. How many participants or volunteers or staff does CHIRP have?
We have 150 volunteers. We have no paid staff. Everybody's a volunteer here.
Could anyone just come to volunteer or say, I wanted to, I've got a great radio show that I think you might like? Well, how would I pitch that? Or if someone who wanted to submit something for CHIRP to consider, what do they do?
I think that what you just said is actually another important thing that sets us apart from some of those other stations that you mentioned, mm-hmm. is that what we really strive to do is to be really consistent in our programming across the board. We don't have specialty shows, so what you hear at any hour on CHIRP is what you'll hear at any other hour. Personality changes with the different hosts, but you know, we don't do an hour of country followed by an hour of punk followed by an hour of electronic music. We don't believe that that's the way people consume music. We don't believe that people only like one kind of music. So, you know, there's not really any coming to us and suggesting shows.
Okay.
Because we don't have individual shows.
So that's probably the wrong tack to take on it. Okay.
But if you'd like to be involved in CHIRP, we have quarterly new volunteer meetings. And for anybody who wants to get started, that's where you absolutely have to start, is by coming to a new volunteer meeting. And you get your basic CHIRP orientation there. You learn about how the organization runs, what the expectations are. We're pretty rigorous in our expectations. And, you know, maybe that's yet another thing that sets us apart. You know, we ask any volunteer that comes to us that they put in 12 hours of volunteering every 6 months. And if they're going to DJ, we ask that they put in 24 hours of volunteering every 6 months in addition to their shows. So we really, you know, because as a volunteer organization, as a volunteer, you know, nonprofit, if we can't rely on our volunteers, the organization doesn't run smoothly. So it's a lot more than coming in once a week and doing a DJ shift. But once you decide that you agree to those terms and you want to be involved, then we just put you right onto the email list and start getting you, involved in different ways, going out and tabling at events, reviewing CDs, and then going, if you do have an interest in being on air, going through the process of training and orientation.
The commitment to rigor, it doesn't sound like, has deterred volunteers from participating in CHIRP.
Not at all. I mean, every new volunteer meeting, it seems like we get more than the one before.
We are recording this interview in a studio that CHIRP has opened. Tell us a little bit about how this came to be.
Right. Well, we found our space here, the CHIRP space, in March of 2009. Mm-hmm. And we started building the space out in the spring. And it was raw factory floor space. We're in a downsized factory, where the two bottom floors are still active, and the third floor has been rented out to a variety of sort of creative interests. And so we decided to completely build the thing out on our own. You know, other than what we had to do professionally, like electricity and IT, we built the walls here. You know, we put up the studs and hung the drywall and painted and laid carpet and built furniture, and it really was truly a volunteer effort. Mm-hmm. And people will say that their blood is in these walls, literally, because they chopped their hand open while they were working. But we really did. We built it ourselves, and the pictures are pretty amazing when you see what it looked like at the beginning to what it looks like now. And so we finished construction. For the most part, in October or November, we're sitting in a studio right now that isn't quite finished, our production studio. But the main air studio was finished at the end of the year, and just a few days before we actually launched our beta testing the first week in January.
How many listeners does CHIRP have online? Any sense of the numbers?
It's because we're still so new, we're a little hesitant to say that because it's fluctuated pretty widely from week to week. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to hold off on saying what we really think we have because we're still figuring those things out.
Don't know just yet.
I will say substantial numbers, though. It's not like 12 people a day or anything. With our numbers, we've been over what we anticipated, which, of course, with the way that you pay your fees when you're an online-only station, you pay per listener per hour. Mm. So we actually, to give you an indication, we expect our streaming fees to be about double what we'd initially predicted they would be based on our first month of listenership.
Let's turn topic a little bit to, I guess, the overall radio scene, not just in Chicago, but nationally. The word dismal, as far as, I guess, its long-term prospects regarding the commercial industry, kind of is what I'm reading the situation to be. There has been talk for a while that Clear Channel Communications, along the 900-pound gorilla of commercial radio, there's been talk, although as far as I know, this hasn't happened, they could go into bankruptcy. Citadel Communications, the third largest radio broadcaster in the United States, did file for bankruptcy. And it seems like that, as far as the commercial radio is concerned, that it's kind of a sinking ship. My feeling about this personally, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, is that it seems like that the commercial radio industry kind of buried their own, dug up their own grave to bury themselves in, given the cookie cutter models of radio production and the fact that they just basically drove off listeners, and also may not have anticipated the influence of the internet as far as a medium for distributing radio. What are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, I think it's totally true. I mean, what radio did over the last decade and a half or so is gave up all of its strengths, and then they wonder why the audience has drifted away as much as they have. And of course, iPods and the internet and all this competition for attention is a piece of that puzzle, but I don't think it's the main piece. And I think the main piece is radio's strengths have always been the fact that it was live and it was local. Mm. It was very immediate. It's radio is a really intimate medium. It's a medium that you allow into your home, into your car, and that you don't necessarily consume it with lots of other people. That it tends to be a really one-on-one thing. And when the big corporations that own stations started working on these economies of scale, where they said stations would no longer be individually programmed, they'd be centrally programmed, and you stopped hearing local and regional hits on the radio, where you'd hear a band that was from your town. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of cases, you even stopped hearing local DJs, you know, or local hosts. You had syndicated shows. You had shows that, you know, aren't known to be syndicated necessarily, that are sort of trying to sound like they're in your town by dropping in weather reports and traffic reports, but in reality they're on the air in, you know, 10 different markets. You have voice tracking, where the DJ who's on the air has recorded their breaks earlier and isn't even in the studio when you're hearing them. And you have just rampant commercialism, where, like I said, you in morning drive, you're giving up 20 or more minutes of your hour to commercials. So all the things that radio used to be really good at, that sense of connection and community, where the listener felt like they'd shared experiences with the person whose voice they were hearing on the radio, so much of that is gone. And that was what made radio different from a jukebox, or, you know, from a record player. And they gave it up, and they thought they could save themselves money and that people would keep listening. They thought that people wanted that jukebox, and they obviously want more. And what we see in the response to Chirp is that people still feel very passionately about radio. And, you know, the response has been really overwhelmingly positive. Like, at last we have a station like this for Chicago. At last I'm able to listen to the radio again. And part of that is, you know, has to do with music selection, but another part really has to do with feeling like there's a station you can feel a personal connection with. A lot of people tell us, well, I was listening to KEXP up until this point, or I was listening to The Current, and those, you know, that's a station out of Seattle and a station out of Minneapolis. So, you know, as soon as they were given a local choice to do that, they were willing to switch. So that really says something about the importance of localism in people's minds.
Is there any sense, my reading of the future of commercial radio could be that at some point we may see these gigantic media conglomerates maybe just forced to break up, and that may help to open up maybe some spectrum or radio stations that maybe Chirp or others could pick up, as far as actually not just broadcasting online or through a podcast or something, but also from distributing it so that you can listen from a car radio, for example. Any sense of looking in your crystal ball about the future of commercial radio?
Well,
any guesses there you want to make?
I think whether by force or just by economic necessity, I think that is going to happen, that you know, the largest corporations are going to start divesting themselves of some of their stations. I think the idea of them, you know, going so far as, you know, having stations become available to small nonprofit organizations like Chirp, that seems probably, I don't see it quite going that far. My hope is that it at minimum goes back to, you know, local or regional smaller corporations rather than big behemoths that are nationwide. I don't know that I see it really going back to that single sort of mom and pop ownership sort of that we saw, you know, in you know, the very earliest days of radio on through the early 1980s or so. I'm not sure that that's coming back. That would be great if it did.
Any predictions for where you foresee Chirp is going in the next 2, 3, whatever years? Where do you foresee Chirp in, like, maybe 4 years' time?
Well, you know, we want to continue to grow our audience. Certainly, that's the most important thing. We do want to offer some other forms of programming in terms of podcasts. What we have is some people who have ideas about irregular programming. And because I was talking about consistency and wanting to have people be able to tune in and kind of know what to expect across the board, you know, we feel a pretty strong commitment to that. But we also think that, you know, some people who come in and say, well, I'd like to do a show once a month about this or that, that that's really something that we can make studio time available and offer in the form of podcast that then we promote while we're on the air. You know, so people can take those along with them and listen at their leisure. So they're not necessarily slotted on the air, you know, because they wouldn't be on a regular schedule. But we definitely want to offer some podcasts, and we've had some good ideas for some programming that is in the very preliminary stages on that.
And for details of how people can get more involved with Chirp as a volunteer, as a DJ, as a whatever, what can they do? How can they get a hold of you?
Our volunteer coordinator is Jenna Murfin. And so anybody who's interested in volunteering should contact Jenna. She's jenna@chirpradio.org.
We've been speaking with Sean Campbell. She's the president and founder of Chirp, the Chicago Independent Radio Project, and we've been and online at chirpradio.org, and we've been talking about Chirp and related matters, mostly to radio and media. Sean, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was an interview with Sean Campbell, recorded on February 17th, 2010. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.